I've worked with a lot of young individuals from 16 to 18, and they are from areas that we're talking about social mobility, that don't really have much access to the corporate world or to the city. And it's fascinating when you speak to those individuals, how many of them dismiss industries or businesses or brands because of what they perceive, that someone like them will not work at an organization like that or won't be accepted.
Hello and welcome to the Business of Sustainability podcast, the latest show in partnership with City AM, in which we'll be discussing the latest trends, challenges and advancements in the sustainability and ESG landscape. My name is Mike Penrose and I'll be co-hosting this alongside my business partner, Alex Smith. You already may know us both as co-founders of Future Plus, the sustainability and ESG management and reporting platform that can help any size of business and any type of business improve its sustainability. This podcast series is for anyone looking for valuable insights on sustainability in business and investment. We'll be hearing from a range of experts in the ESG and sustainability sectors, including founders, investors, innovators, and regulators. We'll look to provide you with expert analysis and opinions on the future of sustainability in business, including some of the challenges facing us all. I'm delighted to introduce today our two excellent guests, Mr. Man Wong, co-founder of Candidate X, and Sunil Dial, co-founder of Candidate X. Lovely to meet you both.
Pleasure to be here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And if you'd like to introduce yourself for our audience.
Sure. I'll go first. My name is Man Wong, and I'm one of the co-founders at Candidate X. I head up product there. Candidate X, just very briefly, we're a social impact and data-led business specifically focused on access and equal opportunities in the workplace.
And I'm Sunil Dial. I am also co-founder of Candidate X. To add to what Man just said just now, actually, what we're trying to do is drive and build, bring a new standard to the recruitment process.
Well, welcome, guys. In today's episode, we're going to be discussing one of our key five themes at Future Plus, diversity, equality, and inclusion, and exploring Man and Sunil's knowledge and expertise when it comes to adding DEI to business talent acquisition and strategies. You and your fellow co-founders all have a background in recruitment, and you've come together to sort of create Candidate X. What was it that you thought was missing from the world that demanded that Candidate X came into life?
So I've been in recruitment for about 15 years, 20 years, and there's all sorts of things that I would say that could be improved, let's be honest. I think everybody's looked for a job and not always been enamored with the experience. But when it came to fair opportunities and inclusion, my experience as someone who's from a minority and now is a father of a daughter really sort of came to the realization that a lot of things needed to be changed when it came to the kind of screening process and an ability for access for groups to get chances at finding work. And we really sort of set off to kind of change that kind of narrative that's in the workplace, really. There's a lot of what people describe as unconscious bias, but believe me, there's a lot of situations where the biases are very, very conscious and people are kind of expressing to you that this is what you need to do, this is what we want to drive, et cetera. Don't send me people with these kind of names. Don't send me people from these sort of backgrounds. And it really sort of made us sort of stop in our tracks as people who work in recruitment, because fundamentally, we're transactional in what we do. If we don't find the individual and get them into the roles, you can't get paid as a recruiter. So, you know, what that left was a bit of a heavy burden on myself, and felt I don't want to have that bias by proxy anymore. So I don't want to. So we got together and kind of concocted a plan as to how to sort of do this, and you know, quit the life of a business that generated money and threw ourselves into something new and wonderful and quite exciting. So that's kind of how it kind of came about for myself.
I think the experiences that I have personally had along the way as well, when I applied for jobs. So just to be clear, I've also worked within industry as a hiring manager for a business and then co-owned my own recruitment business. So I've seen both sides of the process. Myself as an ethnic minority, changed my name to Simon when I was applying for jobs, and I found I got a lot more responses with that. So that was my first experience. Being in the business world, as I went up the ladder of seniority, I saw the more the biased firsthand in regards to maybe pay disparity, maybe representation at senior levels, all the way to when I ran co-owned my own recruitment business, just seeing how unfair it was on how an applicant could be dismissed in seconds because of a name because of what they believe in. And so morally, it didn't sit well with me and my co-founders. And we all have young children who are entering to the workplace. And the only way we're going to progress together and society is to do things quite transparently and fairly.
I mean, it's fascinating you were saying about the rejection as well. When I used to be CEO of a not-for-profit in France, and there was a really interesting study that we were involved in that looked and put it without the organisations really knowing, but looked at two identical CVs that went into jobs, one with a very traditionally French name and one with the name Mohammed listed on it. And nearly every single time, and this is in very, you know, forward-thinking organisations, nearly every single time, the Mohammed job was rejected 9 to 10 times more, the Mohammed name, than the traditionally French name. How do you frame, you said conscious and unconscious bias, how do you frame conscious and unconscious bias when you're looking at things in Candidate X?
So we're tackling it very specifically right now in the application screening process. So, you know, I think it's fair to say every one of us in this room and on the street has unconscious biases, you know, and it's an evolutionary thing where as humans we develop from experiences, we develop from our read on certain situations, and we believe that this can keep us safe, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how it's sort of framed into existence in your own mind. And then how it plays out now in the workplace is that when you're hiring, you tend to be under a lot of immense time pressures. You're probably hiring for a specific project. If you're a recruiter, you're hiring for a specific mandate for organizations, and they're on the phone wanting to know where their shortlist of CVs are. Because of that, it means that people take shortcuts. So a very quick way to, if you have a good relationship with a manager, like we used to have with a lot of different hiring businesses, and that you knew their interests were in sports, for instance, you know, or the culture was very male dominated and they'd like to go out drinking. You know, when you get a CV through that has a very traditional name, for instance, whatever it might be, you start to develop a gut feel as to, okay, I stand a better chance getting this person through the door than and that's how it begins. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people are aware of it. And so the unconscious bias is now conscious. You're aware that you're doing it. Now comes the question, what are you doing about it? And how do you change that? And we're looking at this problem in both a technology and obviously a human kind of point of view. And when it comes to the latter, we have to create from that awareness behavioral change. And that's where we're looking at now when it comes to sort of biases.
Yeah, I think I liken it to other industries as well. I mean, recruitment has existed from the beginning of time and our communities, right? And if I look at the recruitment process when I came to look at it, it hasn't changed in the last 20, 30 years. It's the same process. You get a CV, you judge it within seconds. And you look at other industry sectors, fintechs, insurtechs, where they've utilized technology or utilized new methods to improve a process. And I think with what we're looking to do is to, it's a behavioral change and that will take time. You know, it's not going to happen overnight. But what we can do is reduce the biases gradually within that process. So, and at the same time, educate. So we're becoming more aware of what we're doing, the causes of our actions, but also we're seeing the positivity and the benefits of having more diverse teams through the process.
As you probably know, nearly two-thirds of employees reject job offers from companies that they believe don't have a robust culture and approach to diversity and inclusion. How important is it for businesses to have this built in? What should be in it and how can they best communicate it?
First of all, I think lots of companies have mission statements and values, and we all do, and we use that to build our businesses. What we've seen, though, is how often do you revisit that? And when you do revisit that, how involved are your employees, how involved is the workforce in creating that vision and in understanding those values? And so one of the first things that needs to be revised is everyone included in this process to understand what is it we're going to achieve together as a team? And that's a proof point to how genuine you are as a business. So when someone comes in to look at your business and they see these statements and they speak to anyone else around whoever they may be interviewing for, they then kind of understand and bought in with that, and they can feel that being genuine, I suppose. And it's all right getting someone in. Well, someone might reject a job, but you get people into the business. It's how long they stay. So this is the proof point in regards to, right, I've bought into this now. I really understand where this business is going. it suits me, I'm going to commit myself to this. But in 6 to 12 months' time, if that is not true, it's quite quickly seen by that individual. And so attrition sets in. That then affects your culture within the rest of the team. So you get the negativity building within that. And that could set you back not only money, but it could set you back reputational risk and also a lot of time in achieving your mission.
So, I mean, I changed my name from Alexandra on my emails to Alex because particularly when I worked on the commercial side, I found I got much greater amount of replies to Alex than Alexandra got. And so, you know, it worked, but I was playing into the system in probably a way that I probably shouldn't have and was confirming people biases in probably not a particularly useful way. But also, you know, when you're saying about looking at CVs, you know, we run a startup and I can tell you the amount of times that we spend on each CV is not as much as it probably deserves because of resource and ability. So sort of knowing that we have good intent and we're trying our best, what are some of the other sort of pitfalls that you find that businesses fall into? And what are the easier ways for them to at least recognize or identify those so they can start to make those sort of behavioral changes or cultural changes?
I think it's important to say that every organization is on their own individual specific journey when it comes to things like diversity, equity, and inclusion. And if you take each part on there, what we found in our experience in engagement with organizations is that they gravitate to one of the three letters. And diversity is the common one because quite easily because you can see it. So you can gauge process and people always want to understand how well they're doing, right? So an organization has shareholders, maybe they have a board, whatever it might be, and they want to satisfy those kind of queries. So diversity is a very good one to gravitate towards because you go, wow, we made this many hires that are women, this many hires that are in the ethnic minorities, this many hires in the LGBTQ, et cetera, et cetera. Equity is difficult to gauge, right? And, you know, without the kind of authenticity that Sunil's referring to, you cannot really sort of decipher, you know, what's important to people and why they would want to come and work with you, how they engage with you and how do they stay. But inclusion is the most interesting and challenging one because it's a feeling. You know, how do I influence how you feel about being included? You know, if you come over to someone's house or you go to an event, you're at work. How do you get that? And that's the difficulty of it. And I think the pitfalls, as we kind of refer to it, is that organizations often will look for the shortest one to attack. And they then gravitate towards diversity. And then they bring out things like quotas. Then they want to bring out this, that, and the other, where they end up perpetrating biases through proactive discrimination, you know, rather than actually just assessing people on their merits, bringing people in. Because if you have an inclusive culture and you have inclusive processes, you'll get diversity by default. It will just happen because you've made it as inclusive as possible. One last example on this is, for instance, if you know that you want to engage with neurodiverse candidates, and you know that your interview process needs to be accessible for them. So it could be something that doesn't create barriers from a cognitive point of view, right? So a good example of this was a bank I was working with a long time ago. They had a counter on the top right of their screen when they were doing online assessments. And what we found was a lot of people who were neurodiverse would focus on the counter and not on the task at hand, and then they would be dismissed. Simply by removing that meant that it became more accessible. Now, if you take that approach and make everything as accessible as possible, and basically not to say that this is a special process for you because you are whatever category, but for everyone, then you're going to naturally get a wider net. And that's what organizations often don't do. They don't focus on that. They just focus on how do I talk to that specific group and individuals? And by doing so, it can become quite exclusionary.
When you're talking about, you know, the approach to diversity and looking at diversity, one of the challenges we face is, especially working in London, is we find that an awful lot of people take what we jokingly call the nylon approach to diversity. They consider it in a New York, London type context, incredibly diverse cities where it's about achieving a balance that's representative of the city. Mm. And we have one client here who had operations all over the world and was talking about diversity and saying, right, it was off the back of Black Lives Matter. And they were saying, right, we need more people of color in our supply chain. We said to them, that's great, but you work in the Caribbean. But all the businesses will be people of color. And we saw them thinking about them, or nearly all of them. We saw them thinking about the problem and then saying, okay, well, okay, more minority-owned businesses. We say, but you work in South Africa. A minority-owned business is a white-owned business, but they have 80% of the economic power. So how do you define diversity within a context? And this is the one we find really, really troublesome, because if you're looking for more people of color in an Afro-Caribbean sense and your business is in Hong Kong or India, it's going to be a problem. But how do you then define it in a way that is equitable within a particular context?
I think that goes down to your process. So how do you qualify what success look like for having a good supplier? What is that process do you follow? And it's very much similar to the recruitment process, right? So it's being very transparent about what your process is. What's the qualification that you go through for that? And I think if you could quite clearly, and if you're, as a business, have that commitment to go, this is our process, we're very clear, and these are suppliers for this year, or this is how we qualify them, I don't think you get many people arguing about what the end result is or who you choose. If it's in line with your process. It's when you go off that, or you're not very transparent, you just go, this is our suppliers, this is how you get on there. Or that's when the question marks starts appearing. People question about, well, your suppliers are all this, all from this area, all identified this way. But I think if you're very transparent with your process in the first place, that could set a standard for how you go forwards and others to follow, really.
I think just to add to that, you know, Mike, your question there around, you know, that kind of example you gave, it comes down to data, right? Because if you do the eye test, for instance, our founding team is three fellas, you know, three chaps, and we're very aware of that. You know, we're diverse, etc. But and there are people that will absolutely come at you for that and go, "You're three men. What do you know about this, that, and the other?" And I think that's, if I'm being honest, worst case is lazy. You know, best case is just a bit naive. Where diversity isn't just what people associate with perhaps how the media perpetrate it, where it's got to be ethnicity, it's color-based, or it's gender-based. You know, we have a real wealth of diversity that transcends so much more than that. You know, our modern world right now means that you can be so from different mixed cultures. You can identify as different sort of gender pronouns, right? As everybody knows and talks about, you know, disability, hidden disabilities, care responsibilities. Are you from a veteran background? All these different things create the wealth of what we're talking about, you know, and I think that often gets missed because people just gravitate towards the more, I guess, on vogue diversities that people want to sort of talk about. But the main one, I think there's really the most interesting thing, you know, there's a big debate around about affirmative action at the moment in the US, right? Whether it should be or shouldn't be a thing. And you can see many good examples of where people have benefited from affirmative action, gone to Ivy Leagues, ended up in big corporates. Brilliant. Now, should affirmative action, though, be isolated to the color of your skin? Or is it really talking about access to opportunities in underfunded schools and areas? Because I think that's our biggest problem here in this country right now, you know. So and if we can look at social mobility as how that can be affected, you know, you could be anybody, right? You can be from any background, any gender, and still suffer from lack of opportunities and that sort of access. These are the things that we're talking about. When it comes to sort of diversity. And that's the challenge I think we have in terms of creating that equitable process. Because how do you get that information? You know, how do you get trust to get that information?
It feels like a real trend that's coming through a lot of these conversations that we're having is that, and it's something that we've spoken about a lot as part of Future Plus, is you're trying to measure what is easy and not what is valuable. And that seems to be the predominant theme that is coming out from a lot of these sort of conversations that we're having with people. And I think part of that, you know, we're a high percentage of women, shall we say?
85%. It was kind of this diversity, equity and inclusion part. If you play through the thing in our organisation, Alex and I actively try and recruit men because we are 85% female in the office. It is a load of predominantly much younger than me. For those of you who can't see me, I'm 51. Much younger than me, women in the office. So you have diversity from one measure, some people would say good, but from a cultural perspective and a balanced perspective, maybe not so good. When it comes to inclusion within it, I very consciously know that I am not included in a lot of the conversations or things like this. They don't do it out of intent, but I don't actually add anything of value right to a lot of the conversations that are going on. But there is, luckily, as an owner of the company, I have a certain privilege and position, but you can see how that plays out very much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the equity and equality side of things. We're desperately trying to level the playing field, but we just cannot recruit men who are of the same caliber of the women that we choose. We have some very close candidates, but we always sort of default within a human resources perspective to going, but we've always said we will recruit the best person for the job. Absolutely. Because we need to succeed. So we go for the best person for the job. And so far it's been 85% female within the workforce.
And I'd say within that there is, as you were saying, there's diversity. There's parents, there's there's academic, there's people with operational background, there's people of different socioeconomic background. And I think that's where we get the benefit of, you know, as we said, we need to expand that as we grow in order to sort of change that. And it's something that's really at the forefront of our minds, as Mike said, to sort of level that playing field in the gender balance, but actually also in the socioeconomic balance and also in the neurodiverse. I think 34% last week, 33%, weren't we? About a third are neurodiverse. And sort of really sort of trying to find that balance in a team, but also being very aware that being diverse as an organisation, even a small organisation, but particularly large organisations, as you were saying, is really tricky. Yep. Because being diverse brings more ideas, brings more conflict by, you know, positive conflict, hopefully, but conflict by the by of people having to listen to other people's point of view and not always being able to, a group of homogenous people all saying yes to the same thing. And I think we're finding that's a really big conversation for us, is how do businesses go through the recruitment stage and then, like you were saying, make sure that they retain them and don't lose them in 6 to 12 months, because being diverse can sometimes be tricky. It can be, it's always more positive, it's always more successful as far as we can tell, as far as all the studies and research we've looked at. It's, you know, we know it's a good thing, but it can be really hard as an individual to be in something that's diverse and to have that sort of natural conflict around you.
Yeah, and I think this goes back to when you asked the question about pitfalls that companies make, right? So, well, what we've seen in the last few years is a reactionary behavior, obviously post-George Floyd. Companies quickly try to fix the problem by hiring maybe more individuals from an ethnic minority backgrounds, more from women into the workplace. And thinking that that will have an instant impact into the business and we'll start seeing the rewards. I think what a lot of companies don't realize is that unless they have a robust process, which is very transparent, to get the right person for the job, you could still be hiring the wrong person, right? It seems a bit weird, but just because someone might identify doesn't mean their values and their behaviors are what you're looking for as a business. And it's the knock-on effect that has, because if you just hire someone for the sake of how they might identify into your business, thinking it's the right thing to do, when they get into the business, A, it can cause resentment amongst the existing workforce. If they felt that they've been brought in regards to how they identify, then they start questioning their role within the business and how genuine you are. And before you know, you've got a bigger problem. So I think it's one of the pitfalls is ensuring that you have the process. You get the best person for the job, for the role. Then what you do is you have a plan, a roadmap about, well, how are we going to, so Mike, you were talking about, how do we try to attract more men into the business without, you know, foregoing saying the skill levels or the experience? And it's kind of investing into that. So it may be into communities that your members of, or other groups that you could have access to. And so it becomes a process where you start developing and educating a lot more. And hopefully that will bring through the best people for the role, how they identify. But if you're doing those things, anyone looking in, even from a customer perspective, can see you're doing a lot of this and contributing back. That tells a lot about a business and a brand and someone that you would want to be associated with.
And I couldn't agree more, man. You mentioned earlier the role of data playing in this unit. But for me, that again, that's also fascinating because, and you alluded to it, you know, the worst outcomes in the UK as a whole are white working class men at the moment in terms of socioeconomic outcomes, the ability to climb the ladder. Mm-hmm. And the highest outcomes tend to be young Asians of both genders tend to top the league at the moment. So how do you use data to really understand the landscape, where the divides are, what actually constitutes potentially a lack of equity or a lack of ability to progress that goes beyond what you said at the beginning, what is visual, what you can see ethnicity immediately. Yep. You cannot see socioeconomic, you cannot see neurodiversity. But sometimes the way they then play out can create a bias, whether or not you mean it. So how do you use data to drive insights that help you overcome those problems?
Yeah, I mean, data is very contentious. You know, we live in this world where data is so is spoken in such a way where, you know, particularly with AI now, right? You know, I think it's really accentuated its purpose, I suppose, and what the potential could be done from it. From our side and our perspective, when it comes to DEI, data is incredibly important because you don't need to do an eye test anymore. You don't need to sort of have a gut feel. You don't need to rely on instinct. You can actually visualize things much more deeply and much more specifically to help you create strategies. The problem about why data is so contentious is because in this context, we're wrapping it around the application process. And, you know, generally speaking, if you go on things like Reddit, a fishbowl or whatever it might be, you get real candidate sentiment. And the applicants at the moment are frustrated. You know, they're treated poorly, they're commoditized, they don't hear back. It's terrible. And they've been asked to enter information repeatedly. And that becomes difficult for them because then they don't take forms like data, diversity data, for instance, seriously, because they're going, well, will this be used as a reason why I don't get hired? I don't want to help organizations fill their diversity quota. You know, there's all these real sentiments that come out of it. So there's a big challenge to get that information. And what we're doing is kind of doubling down on it. So a lot of organizations will tend to ask around ethnicity, tend to ask around gender, maybe about disability status, maybe if you come from an ex-armed forces, perhaps. And very little else after that. We use 10 categories, including things like care responsibilities, social economic backgrounds, faith. Faith is a huge one. I worked in an organization where there was a chap who was Muslim. I had to pray in the toilets every Friday. And people, young boys would look at him and go, why has he got his shoes off in the toilet? Not really understanding, you know, his faith, why it's important to him. And it was not dignifying for him. So we looked at these things and go, this is incredibly important to trap, to capture this data, but use ethically. Use in a way that organizations and applicants can benefit from there. So for instance, if you as a job seeker, you fill this data out, do you ever benefit? You know, you don't see that benefit. We want to give that benefit back to the applicants so they can see, actually, what's my worth look like? You know, which organizations are actually doing something for people that like me, for things that matter to me the most? You know, do they have the right policies for me? You know, we live in a world now with COVID that's totally changed everything, right? We're so distributed and we've got other commitments, not just in the 9-to-5 kind of time culture that we've created, where you've got to be on demand, got to be on this, etc. We've got commitments to our kids, you know, to my parents, to my wife, all this sort of stuff, to friends and our communities. And those things matter to individuals. And I think that helps with the engagement that provides those kind of equitable pieces that we're talking about. But it starts with gaining trust of the candidate to declare this information in an earnest fashion that's right and honest so that we can use it in a way that can help literally change the environment that we're talking about here. That's the kind of moonshot we're going for, I suppose, with this.
I think to add to that as well, it's interesting. So we work with a lot of groups or we volunteer as well as individuals. And I've worked with a lot of young individuals from like 16 to 18. And they are from areas that we talk about social mobility that don't really have much access to the corporate world or to the city. And it's fascinating when you speak to those individuals, how many of them dismiss industries or businesses or brands because of what they perceive that someone like them will not work at an organization like that or won't be accepted. So what we're trying to do is bring a new standard. I mentioned at the beginning, but hey, the data now is available. You can now no longer say that we haven't got the data to show how we're hiring as a business. But by doing that, individuals who are seeing this going, oh, hold on, there are people like me that work there. The data shows it. I'm now going to give that a go. I'm now going to go into the legal profession, or I'm now going to go into tech, or I'm going to go into financial services. And I think that provides accessibility as well. So I think it's so important that the transparency, the data is there. We need to use it. It needs to become a standard where every company goes, yeah, we'll show you how we're hiring.
An interesting one, again, on the data, interesting your position on that, because obviously there are innate traits, so that, as you're saying, there's your gender, your ethnicity, and things like this. I think it was Richard Branson's company, I think it's Virgin, forgive me if I'm wrong, but who have removed the requirement to put your educational status down on the paper. Because, again, some people, I come from that group. I have a statement of special educational needs. I left school with no qualifications because the education system at that time didn't cater for my requirements. And Richard comes very much from that background as well. So what's your feeling very much also on removing some of the training or skills that might contribute towards the job in order to create a sense of equity in terms of how you're choosing people? And how can you overcome some of the bias that's innate in, you know, I went to Oxford versus I don't have a university education?
Just like anything on this subject, it's extremely challenging. You know, when I started looking at this piece and kind of designing the frameworks with Sunil, you know, about what we wanted to take off CVs and why, education was a big factor in that, because, as I say, one of the main groups I like to focus on is that kind of social mobility, socioeconomic piece. And if you think about certain professions like law, you know, big four accountancies, right, management consultants, all that good stuff, they are not taking people on who went to a polytechnic. They want Russell Group universities, mainly, you know, back in my day when I was hiring with 28 points, and they don't do that anymore. I think it's thousands of points now or something. But 28 points on your A-levels, et cetera, to get in the door, just to have a conversation, you know. And that systemic way that they've had is so difficult to untangle from organizations. Because if you have an honest conversation with hiring managers in these institutions, you speak to them, they gravitate towards that very quickly. They move to that because they came from that route. Mm-hmm. They know the caliber of those individuals, and that's always their argument. So there's that problem. And then you've got candidates as well with this suffering from that same issue. Because if you went to Oxbridge, why would you not want to say that on your CV? My brother went to Oxford. There's no way he's taking it off his CV. There's no way my mum would let him take it off his CV, right? So I think that's important to take into consideration. So, and you know, what Alex said there earlier around with your own company now, you've got all this diversity in there, which is brilliant, but that creates a new challenge, right? And it's about discourse. It's about how do we enable communication in the way that people can express themselves for those sort of reasons. But should you make a judgment on hiring someone just based on university? That's the difficulty that we're trying to overcome. And if you speak to certain organizations, they're going, I don't hire just based on education. But if you ask them to grade a percentage of it, I bet you it comes in pretty high, right?
However, if Oxford is on there, it's such an interesting conversation. And I, you know, so much of it, I feel like I'm living in real time at the moment as well. You know, we were talking, Mike and I both have teenage children. Just, you know, what you were saying, I absolutely grew up with that thought that there are certain companies that I couldn't work for because I didn't fit into that. And it wasn't even maybe that I didn't think, it was an assumption that it wasn't even a possibility. I didn't even need to think about whether or not they would want me because I'm not university educated. So therefore it was a no-brainer. It didn't take too much thought. And I'm seeing that with my 14-year-old now. We live outside of London. He would be the first in my maternal line to, and paternal line, actually, my mum and my dad side of the family, to go to university. And we're in 2023. That we're sort of slightly unusual for a family, feels slightly unusual. But it's only recently in the last year that's occurred to him, or even in the last 6 months, it's occurred to him that could be a pathway for him, despite the fact that I sort of bang it into him on a regular basis. But it feels like there's a lack of, going back to the education piece, like all the way down to the roots of working with young people, working with schools, to encourage people to ask the right questions of their future employers, to go in with social equity, know how to deal with situations, understand etiquette. All of these things build up that bigger picture, which allows you to present your best self when you're going in and having these conversations. And it was really interesting, I think, the work you're doing around allowing them into the room to have that conversation. But that there must be so much work that sits underneath that in order to give them the opportunity to show it to when they get in the room, or if they get in the room, once you've done, you know, you've got them there to really know what to do and how to do it and how to hold those conversations. I think it's such an, you know, such a wide and interesting subject.
It is. And it's not just the responsibility down to organizations or groups like us. I think it's down to a community of businesses. That's a responsibility we all have to get more involved and actively involved in actually providing that education. So in your local areas and preparing younger individuals about what to expect and why not to discount yourself because you might think this is what that industry looks like. I think we need a lot more of that. Schools need a lot more help. But going back to what, Mike, you were saying just now, actually, about education and on the CV, it's not, it shouldn't only be the only phase of that application or that hiring process. If you're going to remove it, it's cool. Have another stage where it's about skills and you have a specific assessment on that, because that then equals everything. And then you're getting the best person, regardless if they got the Oxbridge qualification or not. So I think it's a combination of looking at things, but we do need to act together, I think, a lot more. There's a lot of businesses running in their own direction, trying to put out fires for their own because of what the shareholders or what the customers might think of them. Well, actually, if you've got together a lot with other organizations, you provide the support, but also it's not about what's going well over there, we need to do better. It's about actually what's going on well over there. Can we adopt that over here? And can we make progress together? And I think that's for the UK at the moment. We need a lot of that to get Britain going again, really, and not only financially, but all across the board.
I think, you know, to what you were saying, Man and Sunil, I think, you know, to wrap it up, some of the really interesting approaches I've seen to this have always been where people are, as you were saying, leaving the door open to other conversations. One of the best ways of overcoming the education question I saw was a statement of, you know, this is the minimum education requirement needed unless you can explain to us why what you have is better or more important. And not just unless it's equal in our eyes, but you offering you, the agency, the ability to explain why what you bring is equal to an Oxford degree and et cetera.
It's context.
Absolutely.
It's context. That's what it is. I mean, just to plug another business that's not us, but Rare Recruit, they do a fantastic tool on that to try and enable organizations to have context based on where, you know, the school that you went to. Did you have an asylum seeker background? Did you, you know, refugee, et cetera, all that good stuff where people need to know in order to evaluate it properly, you know, because, you know, we're not saying if you went to Oxbridge, don't be hired. Clearly not. They all deserve opportunities, but so do these individuals that couldn't go to Oxford. That's all. That's all that we need to say.
We can agree more.
Brilliant.
Amazing. Thank you, guys. That was a super interesting conversation. And thank you ever so much for your time today.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Loved being here. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Business Sustainability Podcast. This podcast is available on all major podcast channels.